Grove versus Ryan. Mr. Farley.
Good morning.
The district court erroneously framed the legal issue in this case by stating that the court must decide whether plaintiffs have a federal right to be placed in a residential facility located at what they deem an acceptable distance from their home. The plaintiffs never claimed that Medicaid services must be furnished at a location deemed to be solely acceptable to the recipient, and never claimed that it must be furnished within a specific distance or time. But the plaintiff's claim was that defendants failed to furnish Medicaid services with reasonable promptness to the plaintiffs, and they're entitled to receive these services in the most integrated and least restrictive setting, which is their community. If the state Medicaid program was operating and functioning...
Are you going to discuss the issue of standing?
Yes. The plaintiffs applied for Medicaid services. They went through their local pre-admission screening agencies. They were found eligible for those services. They were diligent in pursuing services. They cooperated with the PASS agencies. They were never offered a placement, which they refused. They were unable to get services. And the evidence showed during the hearing that services are not being provided on a comparable or uniform basis, which prevents the people from locating services in their community.
My question this way. What exactly is the relief you're seeking so far as the Medicaid part of the case is concerned?
The relief to the plaintiffs would be similar to the relief in other Medicaid cases. When there's a deficiency in the plan, the district court usually orders the state to come up with a plan to comply with federal law, with Medicaid law.
Now, Mr. Farley, I had a very similar question, and I wondered, without holding you to this permanently, but just to give me an idea of where you're going with this, can you articulate for me the injunction, your ideal injunction that you would have the district court enter? What does it say? Go out and write another plan, or does it say write a plan that satisfies certain criteria? Because injunctions have to be reasonably specific, they're enforceable by contempt, and I'm just worried about, to use standing terminology, redressability, to use sort of more general terminology, something concrete enough that I can envision what it is you're looking for.
Well, one of the things would be, which is the state, which admitted that they relied on market forces to ensure that there were adequate providers in the state and they shouldn't interfere with the private market. And the evidence was clear that they have a policy of not allowing certain residential providers entering the market.
So would that part of the injunction say stop requiring pre-approval of construction of intermediate care facilities or community-based facilities?
I think that the Medicaid Act gives a certain deference to the state to come up with a plan. I think the first stage would be that the court would point out certain deficiencies in terms of possible interference with the marketplace. The state also acknowledged on statewideness in their filings that they cannot cluster services in one area or region to the detriment of the other. The state has an understanding of what they should do, and the evidence showed that. Let the state come up with a plan addressing the statewideness of the comparability. If we have to have some expert testimony onto the various plans, at one point during the hearing, after Dr. Braddock, the national expert, testified, Judge Grady said, I believe it was on transcript 722, he says, I don't want to hear any more about remedies in this case. That's beyond the scope of this hearing. But I think that the state has set up a system of their community-based program where people can access services if, in fact, they're found eligible or meet their guidelines. And I think the state can come up with a proposal with opportunity for review and comment, which was successful in the Massachusetts case.
Your concern is with a shortage of facilities in northern Illinois, is that correct?
The shortage is that in an attempt to... In an attempt to make this case manageable, that's what the proposed class was consisting of, people in the Northern District where there is a, we should say the evidence showed that there's an imbalance, a shortage of facilities.
What do you want to do to rectify that shortage?
Well, that the state come up with a plan that people who apply for residential services can receive services within
a
reasonable promise.
How is the shortage to be eliminated? A plan doesn't eliminate a shortage.
The shortage would be is that the state should not interfere with the marketplace, allow private providers, if they want to come forward and serve people, at the existing rate structure which is out there to serve people.
Could I ask you a factual question about that? If one of the, right now there's a provision, as I understand all these briefs, that allows the state to serve as a gatekeeper. Reminds me of something like hospital beds or whatever, airport runways. The state can decide don't build any more ICFs or do build more of these other things. When somebody builds an ICF, do they get money from the state to build that, or do they just get their money as residents are approved to live there? In other words, is the state being asked to subsidize the construction of the ICF, or is it really a true private market? Because I can certainly see why the state would want to have a voice in how much of what kind of thing is built if it's being asked to
pay for the bill. Well, we had testimony from the executive director, Lynn O'Shea from AID, who operates both SILA and ICFDD programs, and said that if they got approval, that the ICFDDs would be as financially feasible as SILAs. Also, we're not taking the position that...
So your answer is no, no subsidy is being sought? Or
I'm saying is that that person did not need a subsidy. As to whether historically, 20 years ago, whether there was some bump up in some rates or startup capitalization costs, I can't answer that question.
These people just want permission. Well, why aren't they the logical people to have standing here? Developers, providers want to provide a service, being blocked by an illegal refusal to approve. So why wouldn't it make sense for them to be the plaintiffs?
Well, the plaintiffs,
because the connection between the interests of your clients and any remedy you got is pretty indirect, because if there's a shortage, there's just no places, and you have to wait until something is built.
Well, the shortage is based on the record indicates that the state only appropriates so much funding for their SILA program or ICFDD.
We weren't talking about subsidies. I thought we were talking about permissions.
Permissions in terms of if an agency opens up a SILA or an ICFDD, the state needs to authorize funding for the rates to pay for the services. Right.
Yeah, I was trying to distinguish between bricks and mortar and the actual payments to the residents. So it's the potential residents who are not getting their money.
Right, and Congress passed a provision, which they added later, to give freedom of choice of qualified providers. So the plaintiffs who are developing disabled and eligible for the services should have the right to exercise the rights to choose a provider who happens to be in their community.
Because they haven't been permitted, how are your clients going to benefit from this lawsuit?
Well, we had filed during the hearing a motion for a preliminary injunction that the court should order the state to not interfere with allowing agencies to build facilities.
Well, that strikes me as at least a concrete thing you're asking for. Tell the state to stop taking certain actions
The state claimed that ICFDD's entitlements and placements do not have restrictive capacity, but their practice and policies, they do restrict capacity because they encourage the downsizing, which eliminates the availability of available pools, and they won't allow additional facilities to be built because if there's more facilities, then they'll have to fund the placements.
Mr. Farley, I know time is short, and I don't want to cut off discussion of this, but I want to reserve a question for you, which is, in what respect is your claim under either the ADA or the Rehabilitation Act different from the claim you're attempting to pursue under the Medicaid Act? Because it's the Medicaid Act claim that gets dismissed on standing grounds.
Correct.
The Rehabilitation Act disappears, and it made me wonder even if we had a final judgment. And then the ADA claim, we have the district court deciding that our earlier decision precluded it from addressing that on 11th Amendment grounds, in the brief from the United States saying that they think subsequent developments might change that. But if the claims are fundamentally the same, then maybe we can just decide them all. If they're different, then that is something I'd like to hear about.
The ADA and the rehab claims, which talks about services being in the most integrated setting and the least restrictive, I don't think there was, the evidence is uncontradicted that community placement facilities are the least restrictive, the most integrative, which would be in the person's community. With respect to the Medicaid claims, separate from the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act, is that our position is that if the state was following the provisions of the Medicaid Act, and services were operating statewide and comparable, and there's no interference with choosing qualified providers, the end result would be persons would be able to access Medicaid services within their community. So it's sort of a back way of entering into your community because you have freedom of choice of providers, comparability. And, you know, the state knows that because they claim you shouldn't cluster areas to one area to the detriment of the other. And in the southern Illinois, where you have 10% of the population, you have one-third of the state available ICFDD beds, in contrast to the Chicago Metro. So the state has interfered with this marketplace. So I think that if the state lived up to what they understood to do, then under Medicaid, you would end up getting services in the community because all these various provisions have been followed.
So isn't the bottom line that your claim as it relates to the Medicaid Act is really one of geographic proximity?
If you look, if I had to do a word search for the word geographic proximity, I'm probably not going to see it in Medicaid. Is it inferred in the sense that you can get services within your community or within a reasonable geographical area?
Right.
If these standards are followed? The answer is yes. And I made it very clear in the litigation.
What provision of the Medicaid Act do you rely on
right.
for that?
That it's a federally enforceable right. That's what I'm trying to get to.
A federal enforceable right,
right.
is if I have a right
for the geographic
to choose a qualified provider, and I would like a provider in Aurora because I'm the parent of Christine Auer, who's been attending the day program for 12 years, I would like her to go to that residential program as opposed to saying she has to move lock, stock, and barrel to southern Illinois. So I would say...
No, I understand that, but where is this, and is there some particular statutory provision that you rely on for this argument?
The freedom of choice of providers is set forth in the Medicaid Act.
Pardon?
Is set forth in the Medicaid
The freedom
Act.
Of choice, and I thought you were also relying on the best interest. And
the best interest.
One of the factors was family.
The best interest, statewideness, and comparability. The state admits, their expert, even Dr. Sunder, that services are best in the community. Judge Grady recognized with the testimony of Dr. Parrish that people benefit by services in the community. I mean, this is almost like in Alexander versus Choate, the court noted that 95% of those people were served in the program in terms of what is the best interest. And here we have almost universal agreement that services are best in the community. And then to say somehow that, no, you have to go down to southern Illinois, I don't think that's appropriate under Medicaid or the ADA.
Well, what was your answer to Judge Wood's question, though, the difference between your ADA claim and your Medicaid claim?
The difference is that the ADA is... In the ADA and the rehab claim, there are some defenses which the state may raise in terms of fundamental alteration. I think in the Medicaid claim, you have no defense in the sense of, if, for example, the freedom of choice of providers or the best interests and services are in the community.
So it's the difference between a non-discrimination statute and an entitlement statute, perhaps?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Farley.
Thank you.
Mr. Pushes? Okay, sorry.
Good morning. May it please the Court? If I might start out, I would like to address the standing issue, which is the first question you raised to Mr. Farley, in the context of an argument that plaintiff has made in its reply brief as it relates to Doug Wildsman. As the Court knows, Douglas Wildsman is one of the four plaintiffs in the case. He has found a placement at an ICFDD in Will County, which is one of the nine counties in which the plaintiff seeks to certify a class, called Burnham House. If the Court turns to our supplemental appendix, page 18 of the supplemental appendix, the Court will find that last year there was a residential facility, a residential opening at Burnham House, and in fact, one of the things we provided to Judge Grady was 301 declarations from every ICFDD provider in the state of Illinois indicating when facilities had openings and when those openings closed.
Could I just ask you for a second, though, whether it's the position of the state that all openings in the state are equal, or whether at least as a factor the community-based nature of a placement is something that needs to be taken into account.
If I might, I'm not sure I understand the Court's question.
Well,
when we talk about equal, when we talk about...
Suppose we have somebody who lives in Galena, and for that individual, a statewide search is made by the appropriate people, and it turns out that the only really good placement is in Carbondale. That's just the same as if it were in Galena, as far as you're concerned?
Under Medicaid, yes, Your Honor, because there is no proximity requirement in any of the Medicaid
positions. But that's not the standing issue.
I'm sorry?
That's not the standing issue.
Well, I thought that related in that we were talking about whether these people actually had a concrete grievance if these various locations were available around the state. And I guess it troubles me that by looking at the Medicaid regulations to think of people, you know, in my home state of Texas, where you could be living in Beaumont and 835 miles away in El Paso, there's a placement. It strikes me that that's a pretty harsh standard. If you're in Crescent City, California, and you can travel 900 miles down to San Diego, everything's fine. If your position is that there's simply no concrete grievance that exists between people who are seeking these placements, as long as the state of Illinois has openings somewhere, that's one thing. If your position is more on the redressability issue, you know, is there really an injunction that could be written? That to me is a different aspect.
We've raised all three elements.
But I think you're talking at cross purposes. You were talking about someone who got a placement in Will County. That's north.
It's so part of the nine counties.
Okay, so how does that? That's one. So I thought your argument was that this plaintiff, at least, has gotten his placement where he wants it. So he's out.
Well, the plaintiff has taken the position that that does not moot the claim, and that's where I was going.
Well, forget his claim. There are the three other people. So
I understand that.
Yes.
The three others.
So even if you knock out this fellow who's now in Will County, you still have the other three.
Let's say an ICFDD provider, another ICFDD provider in Will County said, I'm willing to build a 16-bed facility there, and I'll take any of the three plaintiffs.
Can the state
based on the testimony in the record, I'm sorry, based on the testimony in the record, none of the three plaintiffs would accept it because it falls outside what they're looking for in terms of geographic proximity.
But now you've lost. Now I'm completely lost because I thought Will County was within their acceptable geographical range.
It is, but each of the plaintiffs have their own peculiar desires. For example, the hours will only
accept... But they're not geographical, right?
No, they are. They're part geographic, part otherwise. For example, the hours will only accept the facility within a 30-mile radius. So if there was a perfectly acceptable ICFDD outside of that 30-mile radius, they would reject it. And if it wasn't wheelchair accessible, They would reject it.
Okay, but that's not a standing problem. That may be an unreasonable substantive problem. Right.
Well, I think it goes to causation and redressability. And if I could explain,
well,
Your Honor,
I don't understand. I mean, if their argument is that federal law requires that this facility be authorized within 30 miles tomorrow or something like that, and there's someone who wants to build it, then I don't see what the standing problem is.
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of Your Honor's question.
Well, if their argument is they have a federal right to a facility within 30 miles, what's the standing problem? That may be an unreasonable interpretation of federal law, but why does it create a problem of standing?
Well, see, our position is that there is no proximity or distance.
No, I understand, but you said you were going to start off and talk about standing. That's
right.
Completely different.
There's three, Lujan,
but you're arguing on the merits, is what Judge Posner is saying, and that was my concern, too. A great deal of your brief, I thought, if I was trying to read a brief about whether the statute confers certain rights, did you state a claim? That's not, are you the right person to be before the court?
Well, you need to have an invasion of a legally protected interest to
only
have an injury in
alleging,
fact.
Alleging, though, standing isn't supposed to collapse the full inquiry on the merits into the standing inquiry.
But we weren't addressing a motion, 12B6 motion to dismiss on the Szabo hearing. In Szabo, this court says you can't treat class certification as if you're ruling on a 12B6 motion to dismiss. You need to make the necessary factual and legal inquiries to see if a case should proceed.
As a class.
As a class.
Forget about the class. They say they're not even appealing the class issues at this point. They said that in their reply brief. So we're dealing with individual people's claims who are asserting that there is a certain right they have under each of these statutes, and I certainly recognize that there are different legal arguments you're making about each of the claims, but for the moment, that's what they're saying. Why don't they have the right to pursue that?
They have no standing on their individual merits. Judge Grady noted that standing adds nothing, I'm sorry, class certification adds nothing to the question of standing.
Look, would you just focus, forget classes. Is there a standing problem for any of these individuals? Now, I thought when you said this one of the plaintiffs got a placement in Will County, what you meant was that as to him, the case was moot. He got what he wanted.
We submit it is. Plaintiffs take the position that it's not.
No, they said it was. They said they weren't pursuing anything about that.
No, the plaintiffs said that it did not moot out Doug Wilsman's claim because it was farther away than the mother wanted to travel to visit the son.
Well, that doesn't sound as if there's a problem of standing there.
With regard to Doug Wilsman, we submit his claim is moot.
No, you're very confused.
That's not a standing issue.
I don't think you understand the difference between standing and merit. They can make a preposterous argument about, they can argue that they're entitled to have a facility built in their basement, right?
Yes,
that would be a ridiculous substantive claim. But it would not necessarily raise a standing problem. Standing problem would be if they were asking for something that even if they had a legal entitlement to, it wouldn't benefit them.
Well, I submit they don't have a legal entitlement to.
Yes, that's the substantive issue. But is there a separate standing issue?
They've claimed they had the legal entitlement. And that's why you have to put Szabo over to one side. Szabo's talking about whether you suddenly inflict a class on a defendant. But in terms of an individual claim, once you've asserted the right, then we move on to the other Lujan factor.
None of the Medicaid provisions which the plaintiff cite to or rely upon as creating an injury in fact create a legally protected interest such that the violation of the statute would create an injury in fact to give them standing.
So as to the Medicaid Act, you're saying there's no federally protected enforceable right, therefore standing is irrelevant as to the Medicaid Act. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor.
We don't even have to deal with standing. If you're saying, and we've asked questions concerning that there's no federally protected right, then we don't even have to get to standing on the Medicaid Act. But there's still two other claims that they filed. There's the Rehab Act and
right.
the ADA. So can you speak to the standing?
Rehab, well, they treated standing under the Rehab Act identically as under the Medicaid Act.
But my concern with the Rehab Act is that the last word from the district court was that the Rehab Act survived, and then all of a sudden it vanishes from the radar screen, and maybe it's been resolved, in which case, you know, if you look at the final judgment and you say, well, the district court thought he was wrapping up the whole case, and so we'll just assume it's sub silentio rejected too. We don't know why. We don't know whether it's because he thinks it's the same as the ADA. He certainly distinguishes it for ex parte Young purposes from the ADA. It's really left hanging in a very unsatisfactory way.
Well, I submit, Your Honor, that the plaintiffs have waived their argument on, in connection, waived or abandoned their argument on, as to the Rehab Act.
They have an argument. What if we disagree with you on that? I understand you make that argument, and
yes,
we certainly will look at it. But what if they didn't waive it? What would you then say about the Rehab Act claim?
They have not articulated a Rehab Act claim. In the district court, at various times they argued a large ICFDD is less integrated than a small ICFDD, so we're entitled to a small ICFDD as opposed to a large one. They've never articulated in the district court the type of claim they're now asserting on appeal, which is, if we're not entitled to an ICFDD, give us a CILA. That argument was never raised in any of the briefs that were submitted to Judge Grady.
But the problem I have is the same as Judge Woods in terms of that Rehab Act, that we don't have any specific reason given by the district court as to why that was dismissed.
Because
he says it's legitimate, and then ultimately it's dismissed, and there's no discussion of it.
Because the plaintiffs treated the issue of standing for all of their claims identically, even when Your Honor asked Mr. Farley about, is the Rehab Act, where do you get the argument on the Rehab Act, and he referenced all of the various Medicaid provisions. That's exactly the position they took in the district court. They never argued that the issue of standing for purposes of a Rehab Act claim was different than standing for purposes of the Medicaid Act. And all they ever cited to the court was the Medicaid Act. In fact, the Rehab Act, there was one mention, one sentence in one brief. That's all they ever said about the Rehab Act before Judge Grady. Or to Judge Grady about
that. Back to the standing question for a minute. Are there developers, builders, whatever you want to call them, who want to construct facilities in, proximate to where these plaintiffs live, where their parents
live? Your Honor, my recollection of the testimony in the district court was that there was one developer, Joe Westbrook, Garden Center for the Handicapped, who sought a letter of support, and the department said, we can't give you a letter of support. None of the plaintiffs have ever applied at his facility, and in fact, they would not accept it even if it's built because it falls outside their desired geographic proximity requirements. Now, we did present testimony that over the past 6 years, there were 15 additional ICFDDs and 116 additional beds built in the 9-county region of the state.
And how does that compare to the number of people who are on this waiting list, people who are not being served?
Well, all I can tell Your Honor is that last year the state held a series of statewide forums and they asked people what they wanted. No one wants ICFDDs built.
Well,
in fact, one of the amici were part of a group that went to Secretary Baker and asked for a moratorium on the development of any additional ICFDD.
Let me rephrase my question. It was my understanding that a certain number of people have been certified as eligible for residential Medicaid services. And one can imagine, you know, families are getting older, they've got adult children, they want to see them securely located before they become unable to care for them, etc. There are a certain number of people who've been certified as eligible for residential services who aren't getting them. And I thought some numbers existed in the record, but I really can't recall what they are. So I'm just trying to get some sense of how this number of beds, of new beds you just cited, 113 or so, compares to the number of people certified as eligible who are seeking residential placements who haven't found one yet.
Well, your question is not just a simple yes or no. families, for example, may want their son or daughter placed, but they only want a facility at Misericordia. Or they might be willing to take Clearbrook as well. They don't care about another facility. They don't care about Joe Westbrook in the Garden Center for the Handicapped. They want the best for their son or daughter, and they're willing to wait for it.
Hasn't the state encouraged that by this market-based approach? I mean, it's hard to criticize people for having a preference for a certain place.
We certainly don't criticize families for wanting what they want. But along those lines, what people want is the development of Silas. And that's where the state has been focusing its efforts, in the development of Silas. If you look at the entire range of residential options, you have SNF PEEPs, you have ICFDDs, you have state-operated developmental centers, and you have Silas. And what families want are Silas.
What does Silas stand for?
Community Integrated Living Arrangements. And that's where the state has been focusing its development efforts. They have increased the number of Silla beds from 1,500 to over 6,400 in the past 5 years. And they've increased their spending by 36% on development of Sillas over the last few years. And that's what the state is trying to do. They're trying to move the system away from a reliance on institutional facilities.
Could I just pick up with what you just said? They've increased their funding on the development of Sillas. It gets back to my earlier question about the state's economic stake, if you will, in what kind of thing gets developed. Does the state help actually build things or acquire the properties, or does the state just fund
in
the residents?
In many instances, they're privately, completely privately. There have been occasions, I believe, where the state has provided seed money.
But
it would be
private.
Completely privately financed and privately developed, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cruz.
Thank you.
Mr. Farley, how much time does he have? 30 seconds?
Very briefly, Judge Grady noted in his opinion that there were four providers who were willing to build facilities. Three of the four plaintiffs had, in fact, applied for those facilities and were turned down because of vacancies, and another one had applied to the second one. And Judge Grady said, well, it was speculative whether the people would find it appropriate. Well, Christine Auer had applied for AID. She's been going to their program for 12 years, and I don't think it's speculative that she would want a residential services. With respect to the increase of Silla spending, that's part of the Medicaid waiver funding. And I should note that Dr. Braddock pointed out that the state of Rhode Island commits more waiver money, which is Silla, than Illinois, $78 million versus $74 million. So there's been an increase, but the increase is very minor.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Farley. Thank you to both counsel.